Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth terrorist. I'm a knowledge gangster. I'm a black history hitman. I'm a lie killer, urban gorilla. I gotta be a roughneck.
Free the Black Panthers. FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers. F up the black police. That 13th Amendment. Trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free. Okay, free the Black Panthers, FCBP, stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles, but we still here, finna build here, up coin tail pro. Show, they got me started, lying hearted, I'm the new Mufasa. And I'm all about Umoja, first in Gruz, Usaba. Let's bring back the black families, we need our father. Single mama, son and daughter, that's root of the problem. Wise up, we rise up, unity is so powerful. Black banks, black schools, black owned, black power moves. You telling lies, if you think this shit's gonna be televised. Black power, be scared guys, that be standing there like they paralyzed, huh? We say fuck the system, cause we above the system. We keep ARs and pistols, shotguns that's worth the crystal. But that's for self-defense, make sure we have no issues. Be sure to leave it at the door if you have it with you. This for them freedom fighters, that lost their freedom. Until they freedom, we screaming carpe diem. This for the general, King Khalid Muhammad. We gon' make your day a holiday, I fuck me promise.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP, stand for Free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, tryna make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free. Okay, Free the Black Panthers, FCBP, stand for Free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, up coin sale pro.
RBG, 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 RBG. My sisters, my brothers, the council, the elders, cause that's really all I need. We suited, we booted, don't do it, you stupid, we head to the armory. Black women and goddess, regardless, my heart just don't fuck with misogyny. Bullshit, I don't tolerate it. Melanated, so you gotta hate it. Barack upped up another conversation. Trump finna get inaugurated, damn. Unify or die. NBPP.org.
First and foremost, the new Black Panther Party, no other Black Panther Party, we are not violent. We are for self-defense and self-determination. The most violent group in this country are the police. What is taking place by the police departments to black people across this country is ethnic cleansing and genocide. It has escalated since the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2008. We have a people who are only 13% of the population, yet we make up 80% of the prisons. We have 50% unemployment rate in the black community, and it's actually even more than that because they're not counting our people that are in the prisons. The 13th Amendment says you cannot be made a slave or indentured servant unless you commit a crime. The 14th Amendment forced our people to be subjects of this government. We never had any say in that. We need our own nation.
Dr. Malone, thank you so much for being with us again. It's been about 1 year since we sat down here at the farm to talk to you. And now, unfortunately, you are being attacked not just from the left, but from the right as well. Could you just tell us what's going on?
Yeah, I can only speculate about what the agendas are. The issue is that there's a group of individuals that have all kind of fermented somehow on the Clay Clark tour, the Freedom Tour, and they've all kind of hung out with each other. And these include Stu Peters, Jane Ruby, the Breggins, Peter and Ginger, Peter McCullough, Judy Mikovits, all have kind of gotten themselves all wound up over a couple of really odd, obscure things, at least from my point of view. And they have amplified this in a variety of podcasts, and the Breggins Peter Bregan seems to be on kind of a hate Robert Malone tour. He's gone through multiple podcasts where he just seems to have obsessed over me. The core issue seems to be that someone picked off from my CV, and the lesson learned here is I shouldn't be so open and transparent about everything. Mm-hmm. They grabbed a little phrase off of my CV that I had been serving on the active committee, ACTIV, of the NIH and Foundation for NIH. And this is the group that has many subgroups, one of which is involved currently in the what is used to be Operation Warp Speed and the development of mRNA vaccines. It didn't used to be involved in ACTIV, but it's kind of been rolled up. So ACTIV is operated by the Foundation for NIH, which is, I've objected to, spoken repeatedly, suggesting that it needs to be dissolved. It's chartered by Congress, and it is the channel by which the Gates Foundation and the pharmaceutical industry can push money into NIH and influence what NIH does. It's ostensibly there to facilitate a public-private partnership, and I think it's a source of corruption, and it's corrupted much of what's happened with the drug repurposing effort. I was there at the behest of my client, who was a GS-14 level government employee working for a Defense Threat Reduction Agency, and I'm intentionally leaving his name off out of respect for his position. I was asked to mentor this gentleman, who I've known for years, by another GS-15, the next rank up, a Brigadier General equivalent in the civilian corps, asked to mentor him at the beginning of this outbreak, and I did so, and we worked together through multiple projects focused on drug repurposing. And he asked me to serve as a volunteer non-voting member on this active clinical trials working group, which has nothing to do with vaccines. It was all about drugs and drug repurposing. And the reason for me being there was because we had been trying to get clinical trials started for the combination, testing the combination of famotidine, celecoxib, and ivermectin, these three repurposed drugs. The FDA blocked us from being able to do, this is the DOD, blocked the DOD from being able to do trials with ivermectin. I sat on the committee for a long time as an observer. They allowed me to speak. I was not allowed to vote on anything. I was there in support of Defense Threat Reduction Agency, Chem Biodefense Group, and I spoke about it on Rogan, and that raised concerns and objections, and shortly thereafter they reorganized ACTIV, and I was no longer invited to participate. So this whole storyline that I represent controlled opposition because I sat on the active committee is completely orthogonal to the facts. In fact, one of the things that I said was that the representative from Merck Incorporated that was on the committee actively tried to block the clinical trials of ivermectin that was run through the active clinical trials working group. So I don't get this, and it seems to be people seizing on one little fact. Then they went to the webpage, and they saw that ACTIV was involved in mRNA vaccine development currently, because they're looking at it in the present, not in the past. This all happened in January, where it got reorganized, drawing inferences about, and basically disparaging me and my professionalism and drawing inferences based on a little tiny fact that they got, and they didn't even spend the time to comprehend what the active structure was. And
Welcome, Dr. Malone. If you would state your name for the record, and you may begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. I'm honored to be here. I'm here on a voluntary basis at the request of the committee. I'm not being paid in any way. I just want to get that out of the clear. I'm approaching this as a consultation, a nonpartisan consultation. I just want to make that point really clear. This is a situation that's evolved over two different administrations. The chief of staff of the White House directly pressured the FDA to circumvent their normal processes. This is under the prior executive branch administration. There's plenty to go around here, and I applaud the committee in its focus, which I share, of looking forward and not looking back as much, and trying to figure out what is the root cause analysis, what are the lessons we can learn, and how can we improve, in your case, the care of the residents and citizens of the state of Texas. That's my remit, and I'm here to do my best to serve the committee in that capacity. I was asked a series of specific questions by the committee, which I will attempt to respond to. I'm going to cut a couple of those short. You have my written testimony. My name is Robert Wallace Malone. I'm a physician licensed in Maryland, a graduate of UC Davis, UC San Diego, University of Maryland, and Northwestern University, as well as Harvard for a fellowship in clinical research. I've attached a biography and CV to save you a bit of time. I spent my career working in the field of medicine, particularly in vaccine technology and biodefense. I am a vaccinologist. Earlier in my career, I had a series of discoveries when I was at the Salk Institute that led to 9 issued patents filed approximately 1989 to 1990 that are considered by most to be the foundation technology upon which the mRNA vaccines have been built. There have been additional advances since then. I don't take credit, and I did not in any way claim to have invented these vaccines. Just wanted to get that out. I'm a specialist in clinical research, medical affairs, regulatory affairs, project management, proposal management, particularly large federal grants and contracts, vaccines and biodefense. I've won well over $2 billion in grants and contracts. I often chair, or in the past have chaired, study sections for large vaccine grants and contracts for the NIAID. I've met Tony Fauci multiple times. I am a deep specialist in government affairs, particularly in the vaccines and biodefense space. I particularly work with the Defense Threat Reduction Agency historically, so a branch of the Department of Defense focused on biodefense. I'm here to talk to you about the policies relating to vaccines and early treatment for SARS-CoV-2 through the various surges, and my thoughts and recommendations for future public health events as the committee has requested that I do. I'll do so to the best of my ability in speaking plainly. I hope that nothing I say will offend. That's not my intention, and I'm certainly not here to point fingers or to cause rifts or conflict. In terms of my own experience, I've been deeply involved in multiple prior outbreak responses, including AIDS, the post-anthrax and smallpox scare. I actually did a lot of the due diligence for the smallpox vaccine products for the Department of Defense and their adverse events. I'm deeply experienced in influenza vaccine development, Ebola, Zika, and now SARS-CoV-2. I've been working nonstop on SARS-CoV-2 since I got a phone call from Wuhan from a member of the intelligence community on January 2nd of 2020. During prior outbreaks, in my experience, CDC served as a reliable source of impartial, up-to-date, and accurate public health data for physicians, state, and local public health officials. Prior to SARS-CoV-2, the teaching and practice in governmental response has been that the federal CDC advises state public health authorities who have the authority and responsibility, according to the U.S. Constitution, to manage their own public health policies and regulate the practice of medicine. This is your responsibility, and up until the present, that's always been acknowledged. The role of the federal government is in consultation and support and advice. This approach has not been implemented during the COVID crisis, as we've been discussing. During SARS-CoV-2 COVID-19 outbreak, new policies and practices have been implemented. The NIH, and particularly NIAID, have developed and propagated treatment protocols throughout the United States. I was very glad to hear the testimony of the prior contributor about his own hospital practices. In most cases, the protocols developed by the NIH have been developed in a non-transparent manner without hearings or significant public comment by independent physician, practicing physicians. Apparently, these have been developed largely under the strong influence and oversight of a small number of government officials, predominantly Dr. Fauci and his former trainee, Dr. Birx, particularly under the prior administration. Development of vaccine products have been accelerated, and historic non-clinical, clinical development and regulatory practices have been discarded in a quest for speed under specific pressure from the executive branch in the prior administration. Development of repurposed drugs and treatment strategies have paradoxically been aggressively blocked or inhibited by both NIH and FDA, apparently due to requirements in the Federal Emergency Use Authorization statute language, requiring lack of available alternatives as a predicate to granting emergency use authorization to a new product, including a vaccine product. In this case, with this outbreak, the CDC has played a more supportive role to NIH, in contrast to prior, where NIH NIAID has focused on clinical research and early product development, and the CDC is focused on public health policy. We know, according to the New York Times article in President's Day, that the CDC has become politicized, particularly during the current administration, and has actively withheld information which has been deemed as posing risk for exacerbating, quote, vaccine hesitancy. During the current outbreak, the CDC has not fulfilled its traditional role as a neutral collector, arbiter, and reporter of public health data. CDC has, under FOIA, admitted to failing to perform obligated monitoring, analysis, and reporting of VAERS and related vaccine safety data. We heard testimony earlier about the reliance of the state of Texas personnel on the evaluation of VAERS from the CDC, and we now know that the CDC failed to perform their required tasks relating to VAERS analysis assigned to them by Congress. As a consequence, neither patients, physicians, nor public health officials have been able to assess up-to-date information concerning vaccine effectiveness and safety. This has compromised the informed consent process. CDC has actively promoted and marketed vaccination with an unlicensed, emergency use authorized product with over $1 billion in U.S. federal funding expended to both market the products and to censor those who have raised concerns regarding vaccine safety and effectiveness. This is not an opinion. It is well documented through Freedom of Information Act document disclosure. FDA, NIH, and CDC, together with World Health Organization, have cooperated to actively restrict, demean, and deprecate the use of multiple currently available licensed drugs for treatment of COVID-19 by licensed practicing physicians who are the ones who have the authority to establish local standard of care, not the CDC and not the NIAID, and have facilitated retaliation against physicians who do not follow the treatment guidelines established and promoted by the NIH. I was very glad to hear that is not happening with the hospital that was just testifying. Historically, the NIH has neither mandate nor significant prior experience in developing and implementing universal treatment guidance and protocols, and has done so in a unilateral manner without seeking meaningful input from practicing physicians. NIH leadership has acted to restrict and retaliate against highly qualified independent physicians and medical scientists who question federal management policies. We know this most notably in the case of the Great Barrington Declaration and the primary authors of that document. Again, freedom of information disclosures of emails. It's incontrovertible. On a national basis, without respect for state boundaries, this is key, or coordination with state governments, NIH and CDC have actively engaged with and directly paid corporate media and technology and social media companies to promote federal positions and policies and to censor any discussions of policies, risks, adverse events, or treatment options other than those which they have endorsed. Again, multiple FOIA documents demonstrate this. There is evidence in the case of the state of Florida and Governor Ron DeSantis that the federal government has intentionally withheld monoclonal antibody therapeutics as political retaliation for COVID crisis management policies implemented by the state of Florida, which are not aligned with federal government policies and mandates. Now, in Section 3 of the request from the committee for my comment, they asked a series of questions relating to the effects of vaccines and the now remarkably enhanced reinfection rate in the United States population. Those questions included some detailed Let's say, inside baseball questions having to do with the nuance of nomenclature, of effectiveness or efficacy, et cetera. I'm going to pass over those unless there's reasons for questions that are available to you in the document in the interest of time. During the COVID crisis, the use of the terms immunity and effectiveness have been applied creatively by the NIH and CDC leadership, first to refer to prevention of infection, replication, and spread. Then, as those endpoints were not being met by the vaccines, to prevention from hospitalization and death. Then, as those endpoints were only partially achievable, to a relative reduction in hospitalization and death, which currently, based on the latest peer-reviewed data, is in the range of between 30 and 60% of fully vaccinated persons in high-risk categories are still at risk of hospitalization and death. Again, 30 to 60% of fully vaccinated persons in high-risk categories are still at high risk of hospitalization and death if infected by Omicron. The term durability of immunity, or how long does it last, is subjective, as is the term immunity. As you can appreciate from the above, you really have to define durability in terms of the effectiveness of the product to prevent some outcome like infection, disease, hospitalization, or death. In general, the durability of protection from disease, hospitalization, or death from natural infection, what many call natural immunity, appears to be equal to or considerably greater than that provided by currently available SARS-CoV-2 vaccines, which is why frequent readministration of these EUA products is required. I disagree with some of the prior testimony. Perhaps I'm just up on the latest literature because I'm obsessed with it. But the data are showing throughout the world, most recently in Canada and Ontario, that the majority of people, vast majority of people being hospitalized currently are fully vaccinated with the Omicron wave. Furthermore, there's a high incidence of reinfection with Omicron, as the committee has appropriately asked for me to comment on. The high reinfection rates currently observed with Omicron, this is based on a recent review of papers. There is at least a dozen peer-reviewed major papers from the likes of Nature, Cell, Science, the top journals. They are observing and characterizing these high reinfection rates observed with Omicron. It seems to be the consequence of three key factors. First, evolution of viral antibody escape mutants, particularly involving alterations of the spike S1 protein subunit. That's the part that's outside the cell that gets cut off. That's the S1. The S2 sticks to the cell. And in particular to the receptor binding domain, that's the little part that sticks out that binds to ACE2 that most of the antibodies are directed against for therapeutic antibodies. Evolution of viral escape mutants, particularly involving alterations in S1 and the receptor binding domain region, which are able to evade antibody binding by either therapeutic monoclonal antibodies or naturally occurring antibodies. We've had this discussion. Most of the monoclonals are not working against the current Delta strains. That's the truth. Particularly those elicited by the original Wuhan version of S1, which is present in the vaccine. In other words, the people that have been vaccinated or have been infected with S1 are particularly susceptible to the evasion that has evolved in the case of Omicron. The ability of the virus to evolve to escape T-cell responses seems more limited. You'll recall that the two adaptive parts of immunity are antibody or B-cell and T-cell or cytotoxic T lymphocyte functions. We need both. The ability of the virus currently to evolve to escape T-cell responses seems more limited, particularly in the case of natural infection, which provokes a broader T-cell response because people are seeing the whole virus. Administration of leaky vaccines is another contributor. Largely unable to block infection, replication, and spread of the virus may contribute to the evolution that we're seeing with Omicron. There is evidence, this is key, there is evidence that infection of individuals who are immunologically impaired or compromised, in other words, those with immunodeficiencies, I'm not just talking about AIDS, there's a lot of different kinds of immunodeficiencies, such as people have, we were talking about organ transplantation and cancer treatments. These people may often become chronically infected with Omicron. And these appear, according to the science, the latest publications, to be the individuals that are disproportionately driving the development of the escape mutants. So I've been wrong. Gert von den Bosch has been wrong. It's not happening necessarily in all of us because we've been vaccinated or have been previously infected. It appears that the evolution is happening in people who are immunocompromised in some way so that they become chronically infected with or reinfected with Omicron. Key point number two, multiple high-profile peer-reviewed papers indicate that immune imprinting, you're going to hear more about this. Another word for immune imprinting is original antigenic sin. That's often easier to remember because it's kind of sexy. Immune imprinting is super important by prior infection or vaccination, which may be further exacerbated by infection followed by vaccination, followed by infection with Omicron. This is a Science paper published two Fridays ago. Major study, healthcare workers in the UK over time. Yeah, so major study just published two Fridays ago, Science magazine looking at healthcare workers over time that have received prior infection, often with Wuhan, then a full series of vaccines, and then been infected with Omicron. They've done detailed analysis of the B and T cell responses. I feel like we're getting down into the weeds. I hope I'm not being too technical. But that's the context. What's being observed is a paradoxical reduction in neutralizing antibody. SARS-CoV-2 antigen-specific B cells, memory B cells, and SARS-CoV-2 antigen-specific T populations. In other words, the immune imprinting from original Wuhan followed by multiple doses of vaccine, which are also Wuhan spike, right? Because that's the only vaccine we have, is driving immune imprinting that is causing patients, when they get infected by Omicron, to not be able to respond. They're actually developing an immune, a relative selective immune deficit. This is measured and reported. These people are being set up and have, as about 30% of that population, a much higher risk for reinfection and chronic reinfection. So yes, in fact, this problem of immune imprinting is driving in significant part the chronic reinfection that we're seeing in fully vaccinated individuals. And the data suggests that if we keep boosting these people, it's going to get worse. Now, what is immune imprinting? You're asking yourself, what the heck is he talking about? As I was talking to Bob, I used a metaphor about warfare. We all understand that we're always best prepared for the last war. Our experiences bias what we do. The same thing happens with your immune system. By the way, we were talking about flu. This is a problem with flu vaccines. Any of you notice that the flu vaccine efficacy is in the tank right now? About 30%? Same problem, immune imprinting. What you've seen before, what your immune system has seen before, biases how it responds today. And Omicron has exploited that and evolved to basically escape the ways that your body can control it based on the virus that it's seen previously. And that's what's going on. That's why you're seeing these reinfection rates. And the data suggest that if we keep jabbing folks with the Wuhan strain, we're just going to make it worse. Up to 30% of individuals who are infected by Omicron after vaccination are not well protected from hospitalization and death. It's not everybody. It's a subset, and appear to develop a reduced immunity which can enable frequent and rapid reinfections or chronic infection. As with the immunosuppressed that I mentioned before, the cancer patients, etc., these individuals may disproportionately contribute to further development of more infectious and or pathogenic viral escape mutants. Immunology is complicated stuff. And it just the idea that I wish it was true, more is better, is absolutely not the case with immunology and vaccines. Now I'd like to speak to the last point that the committee has asked me to opine on, which is a public policy question. And I've been spending an awful lot of time talking to people and thinking about public policy, thinking about what we can do to make things better, thinking about what's happened here and what changes need to happen in the federal government. but you don't care about my opinion about what we need to do about the federal government. You're asking me about what can the state of Texas do. So my comments are addressed to that. In my professional opinion, it is my professional opinion that in the case of the COVID crisis, we've seen an unprecedented weaponization of public health policies to advance political and economic agendas which are not directly related to public health. The state of Texas, in my opinion, must implement independent state-based public health monitoring analysis of infectious disease risks and outcomes, as the CDC is no longer providing the reliable, transparent, and comprehensive timely data necessary for Texas physicians, public health officials, and patients to make treatment and management decisions based on complete and accurate data. And I'm very glad to hear the committee is well familiar with this, as shown by the testimony that they have brought before today. In my opinion, Texas must have its own capability to capture these data and analyze these data in a timely fashion. It's also my opinion that the federal government has incrementally usurped the constitutional rights of states to regulate health care and the practice of medicine. And this has been accomplished using a variety of coercive tactics. You've heard about CMS. These tactics have included, but have not been restricted to, just perverse financial incentives leading to overreporting of COVID morbidity and mortality. Coercive, arbitrary, and capricious federal tactics have also included incentives and mandates for inappropriate use of experimental emergency use authorized pharmaceuticals, in my opinion. As with other aspects and activities of the federal bureaucracy, such as education, agriculture, and transportation, states' rights to regulate health care and the practice of medicine have been usurped through threats of withholding federal tax dollars and programmatic funding in the event of noncompliance with federal guidance and mandates. You heard testimony to that effect earlier today. It is my opinion, as a specialist in regulatory affairs, that the rights of the FDA to regulate pharmaceuticals arises from the federal rights to regulate interstate commerce. It is my opinion that these rights do not extend to practices such as pharmaceutical compounding, in which the commerce is restricted to within state boundaries. It is my opinion that states such as Texas have the constitutional right to regulate their own food, medical, and health industrial practices. And therefore, there is an opportunity to foster both innovation and economic development through establishment of a state-based regulatory authority to oversee and direct those activities for which the federal FDA provides oversight in the context of interstate commerce. It is my opinion that outsourcing biologic and drug manufacturing and development to non-U.S. providers, typically based in China and India, represents a threat to national security as well as a threat to the health and safety of the people of Texas. I believe that there is both a pressing unmet need for domestic biologic and drug manufacturing, an obligation of the state of Texas to protect the health of its citizens by addressing this unmet need, and a business and economic development opportunity for the citizens of the state to work with the government of the state of Texas to expeditiously address this problem. There's a national problem, it's also a state problem. In sum, in closing, during the COVID crisis, I believe that what we've seen is an unprecedented encroachment of the U.S. federal government into the practice of medicine, the circumventing of both bioethical and regulatory norms that have been developed over decades, and heavy-handed and politicized federal implementation of a wide range of interventions in our communities, our businesses, churches, schools, government, monetary policy, and general commerce. In retrospect, it's difficult to interpret these actions as representing rational responses to the true public health threat of COVID, in my opinion. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, which has served to protect the health of all citizens, has been politicized and weaponized for advancement of political objectives. This is documented. Going forward from this point, responsible stewardship and protection of Texans' public health will require courageous political and individual leadership, such as I've seen here in this committee, coupled with a willingness to enable development of a state-based, innovative, entrepreneurial solutions to both the current and future public health needs of the citizens of the state of Texas. I know I've gone over my time. I thank you so much for your patience. I hope my comments are received in the manner they're intended, which is not to be generating conflict or controversy, but to honestly be serving the committee as a consultant in helping you to identify opportunities moving forward that would advance the needs of the citizens of the state of Texas. Thank you.
So, Dr. Malone, we'll go to questions, but I know in your opening statements you laid blame at both administrations, which I think is very fair, and that your thoughts of potentially the independent collection of data and how we use that and some of the recommendations, which is, you know, I know we're going to have speak Dr. Bearwinkle and some legislation that we passed last session and then funded during the special sessions, is interesting. I do think some of the testimony today talked about, you know, public health is local. I mean, we've talked about how the different RACs do their business, and we're a little bit fragmented. We're a very large state, but that things are like you asked a question, Senator Perry, about some of the modeling for Dallas-Fort Worth is really not applicable to Lubbock because there's different factors. And so I think what you're bringing up is a good conversation for us to really wrap our thoughts around as we move forward again and use the lessons learned. So,
in my opinion, Texas is clearly a medical powerhouse. The state has developed amazing infrastructure and resources and has been a leader, truly a laboratory of democracy in the area of healthcare. And I think even relative to Florida, Texas has an opportunity to continue to provide that leadership and almost a moral obligation to do so.
Thank you. And so thank you for being here. As I promised everybody in my opening statement that we were going to hear from all angles, because I think we have to really, I like to say, shove our chips to the middle of the table and sort them out and say, what did we do right and what did we do wrong? I'm going to start with the vice chair, and then I'll move to Sir Hall.
Thank you. Breath of fresh air. Let me ask just broad from a 10,000-foot view. So what I understood you said, there were actually legitimate alternatives to the COVID that we knew of the past, although this one was a mutant that kind of took on a different level. But there was other treatments out there before we rushed a vaccine. That's what I heard you say. But
that's my strong opinion, and that comes from not just physicians here in the state of Texas that I've been privileged to work with. You'll hear from Peter McCullough. Richard Urso's another one.
So I'll give you a reference.
Also from all over the world.
February of 20, senators got a call. We were all on the same line. The world was coming in tomorrow, possibly. This was Ebola. It was going to kill 99% of the people it touched. We fast forward to about May or June of 20 and figured out that that's probably not accurate. But where I'm going to go with this is this. So we can talk about what ifs. If we hadn't done the vaccine, if we had let herd immunity, if we hadn't locked people up to where they couldn't have herd immunity opportunity, if we had left the virus to its own kind of, that's not the important. What you said today, though, we've been hearing since mid-20s that you got to watch out in 3 to 5 years for X. We're having signs of what X is faster. Actually, we're kind of coming into that third year, right, and beginning to show up. Germany's deal where some of the spike protein has gotten into the reproductive systems. That was foretold and predicted and laughed off earlier. So we bypassed the vaccine process, I think well-intended on the front end, but it quickly morphed to politics. It was a large reason why the presidential race, I think, moved the way it did. I think people were legitimately fearful for the narrative is out there, and they were looking for someone that they believed could fix it, so to speak. So I do think it was. What, number one, was it the removal of immunity or giving immunity under the Emergency Powers Act that you think was the lots of reasons why we did it? But Was that one provision of removing the immunity under the Emergency Powers Act? That's what granted these pharmaceuticals to go out here without any kind of recourse. Is that one of the factors?
So that's one of the drivers. That has often been done in the past, and as you know, that has been essentially the policy that reactivated or reinvigorated a collapsing vaccine industry in the United States historically. Another one is that this is inside baseball, federal contracting mechanism called other transactional authority was used, which also absolved the pharmaceutical companies of liability. There has been a stack.
So let me back up. Is that a good viable public policy or not? Is there a reason that should be waived or not? Here we waived it in the name of expeditiously to try to get the vaccine out.
The logic for using, and I'm deep in federal contracting, actually work some of these deals. The logic for bypassing the federal acquisition regulations is that it is too burdensome or onerous on the contractor. But that comes at a risk. And in this case, in my opinion, Pfizer actively exploited that situation. The logic was that if we were to bypass standard federal acquisition regulations, then we could get the contracts in place and get moving a lot quicker. So the best of intentions. But now, for instance, in the case of Moderna, Moderna is turning that back and saying, well, in the case of the lawsuit that's coming at us from the Canadian company that developed the technology for the delivery that is suing us, we're now able to transfer that liability back onto the federal government. The federal government and national governments all across the world have ended up being bag holders here. And if you have an opportunity to look at the Pfizer contracts that were put in place, if you have any background in the law, I think you'll find they're fascinating.
Here's the $50 question, and I want you to answer it as honest as you believe. You kind of led into what it has become. Your dealings with all the federal contract, the medical industry, you said I got a call from Wuhan in 20, so obviously you're connected. What was the agenda? Why?
So the big why and the big how has bedeviled me for our 2 years now.
Is it money? Is it power?
I cannot account for the dysfunctional public health policies such as the lockdowns that clearly caused more damage and more death than they saved. I cannot account for a number of these public health policies as being about public health. There's a school of thought that this is a crisis which has been exploited by others for economic benefit. And I'm not talking about the profit generated from the vaccines, although that is substantial. That pales in comparison to the damage that's being done economically across the world from the lockdowns and the shutdowns. You can't explain this based on Pfizer's profit or even Pfizer's market cap. It's my opinion, increasingly I'm compelled, that there are other agendas here that have been superimposed on this. And what I believed for a long time had to be a crazy conspiracy theory, this Great Reset, that was a book title published by the head of the World Economic Forum 4 months into the outbreak that spoke specifically about exploiting the outbreak for other purposes having to do with an economic agenda. In fact, we should take that seriously. That appears to have been the case. It appears to have been, whether, you know, all the nuance of where did the virus come from, how was it generated, was it intentionally released, was it inadvertently released, all that stuff is unanswerable. But I believe that when you look at the data, the information about the policies, when they were implemented, the monetary policies that were implemented that we're now living with, the consequences of, those data can best be fit as consistent with the plans of a group of people who had strong economic interests. And it's very difficult for me to account for the policies.
Got it. So last question for me. if I understood you right, there's about 30% of the population that we continually go back and re-vaccine, and that's actually to the harm. Is there another population segment? I guess I'm asking it this way.
I think you may have misunderstood me, Senator. In the data show that in those, because frankly, we have all virtually either been vaccinated or infected. So what's going on with this small subset? It seems to be about 30% of high-risk persons, based on the data, that are getting chronically reinfected by Omicron. That's difficult to understand. And the answer, based on the data and multiple publications, is that in the case of Omicron, it's evolved to a point where it's not only escaping the immunity, but is actively exploiting the immunity that's been generated, suppressing immune responses.
Layman's terms, and obviously the medical industry's not hanging on every word you say today, but are we on a track that we need to continue with the exception of the subset? Are the other 70% out there a beneficiary of a vaccine, or is it just futile, not doing nothing, or we don't know, truthfully, what the long-term impact is?
So my honest answer is that, in my opinion, currently there is no medical emergency, and that's also the opinion of the 17,000 physicians and medical scientists that I represent in coming here to you. That said, none of us can anticipate the next waves of evolution. I have a colleague, a close friend, Gert von den Bosch, who's been darkly muttering for quite a while that there is no, that he anticipates the evolution of a more pathogenic form based on the public policies that were currently implemented. I hope he's wrong. But based on what we're seeing, I cannot predict what things are going to look like 6 months from now. I know that currently we are nationally running at about 70% occupancy of beds. We do not have signs of a medical crisis currently, in my opinion. But to be honest, there is no way that any of us can predict what things are going to look like even come November, in my opinion. I hope I've answered your question. I wish I had better news.
Let me follow up on that. When you say that, is a different strain, how it's progressing, could it get worse? I'm hoping we're going
to
an endemic.
That's what Gert, the honest truth is there's some nuance in the latest mapping data, and it's extremely technical. It's very, very hard, even for me with my background, to dissect those data. There's a major paper that's coming out in Nature from a Chinese group that's comprehensive that shows that some of those mutations shift some of the sugar residues in ways that are consistent with what Gert has been predicting could lead to a more pathogenic form. There is no way to predict at this point in time if we're out of the woods. We are absolutely in an endemic phase, in my opinion, as normal beta coronaviruses have been endemic throughout all of our lives. We all understand we were all infected with the coronavirus before any of this started. Okay, so this whole logic of priming and boosting is gibberish. We've essentially had nothing but boosting with both the infection and the vaccines. That's the immunologic truth. But I cannot predict, and I don't think, if anybody tells you that they can predict what things are going to look like 6 months from now, I would advise that you immediately conclude that they don't know what they're talking about. There's no way to predict, and it is conceivable, absolutely conceivable, that we could see the evolution of a more pathogenic form. But currently the 0.4 and 0.5 versions that are more highly infectious are not more pathogenic. So yay. That does not mean that 0.6 isn't going to be different. And I think that we have to be honest about that. And to my mind, what that reinforces is if I was, just as I advised the mayor of Honolulu, 9 months ago, I said, get your stockpiles in place, particularly with antivirals, the strategies for treatment, get prepared. It's way better to be over-prepared and and not have it happen than to be underprepared and caught with your pants down.
Senator Perry,
while I'm here, just real quick.
Follow up and then
yes or no answer. Did we do more harm than good?
Absolutely. You can always do. It's always possible.
Ignoring whether it was deliberate, how it mutated, how it came about, whatever the agenda of the day is or where it was back then and maybe it got loose, have we done more harm than good in hindsight?
You're asking retrospectively.
Hindsight came back.
The case, okay, so I'm not going to give you a yes or no. I'm going to give you a maybe. A case could be made that we have done more harm than good, but there's no way to actually know that because we didn't run the experiment.
When you say we didn't run the experiment, because?
Because we intervened in the way that we did. So
with the vaccine.
With the vaccine, precisely. With this blind rush to push out this experimental technology on a universal basis. We could have been a little more incremental. As the great, I have written op-eds. We could, Peter Navarro and I could only get them published in the Washington Times. They were so controversial. What did we say that was so controversial? We said, focus your vaccination on the people that need it most and don't vaccinate everybody and make it so that people have tests available. They can home test. It turns out the administration did implement that one. But the primary focus was, in our recommendation, start with deploying it to the people that need it the most, largely 65 and over and morbidly obese. And if we had done that, we could have still captured the data that we destroyed by vaccinating the control group in the original studies. There's a lot, and if we had been more objective, a little slower to draw, you know, we're here in Texas, I shouldn't have been so quick to draw and shoot. It would have been better if we kind of gave ourselves a little more time and thought a little bit more about it. And then we could answer your question, but right now, largely we can't. The one place we can is we could look at the data in the emerging economies that have virtually not accepted vaccine at all. And the overall mortality rate in the United States is among the top in the world. That is unassailable. And the mortality rate in a lot of the emerging economies that for whatever reason have not vaccinated like this are way, way down the list. Make of that what you will.
Senator Hall. Yep. Get close to that microphone. There you go.
I am.
Sir.
Thank you for your testimony. Let me see if I want to jump back and take off from where they left off and go back where I thought I was going to start. Isn't it? We can't go back and change anything. We are where we are. And the future is truly unknown. But we have a we can make a decision on which path we're going to take. And right now, we're still on the same path we were on when this whole thing started. That is, vaccinate everybody as many times as possible until you run out of vaccine. And what I'm hearing and heard is that we are creating a problem here in people who have already developed natural immunity getting a vaccine are going to go backwards.
That is what the data say.
That's what the data, okay. Now, but I'm looking for something where you keep, we talk about we can't know what's going to happen in the future, but we have to look at where we are with the data. And so if that's the case, and then looking back in the what if question, which we have a lot of data said that really worked. And I'm talking about preventative and early treatment with existing therapeutics and answering the question, why didn't we focus on that more? Because we had such great results where it was used in there. And I think we're going to hear from some doctors in a few minutes that had tremendous success with it. In that we go forward and say, okay, this is not an emergency. We're not accomplishing anything with the vaccine. So let's stop it. And let's go forward with a plan that says we're going to address the symptoms as they arrive in the future and learn from what we did in the past that there are ways to treat what's going to happen without trying an experimental vaccine that has turned out to be counterproductive?
In my opinion, if we 6 months from now, let's say November, we're going to look back and we're going to say, Bob nailed it. That was exactly what we should have done. There have been tests of new vaccines that express Omicron-based spike, and they are not working. Okay, immune imprinting is a problem that immunologists don't know how to solve. I'm sorry to say it. I don't know how to make your immune system go backwards in time. None of us do. And I think that we're in that situation where if we continue doing what we're doing, we're just going to drive ourselves further and further into a hole. And I do feel that what in my opinion, 6 months from now when we look back, we're going to say we had no choice at that point in time, no rational choice based on the data that have come out, other than to stockpile and develop and deploy treatments as quickly as possible. That means identifying infected patients as early as possible and getting them treated before they ever go to the hospital. I think that is our only way forward, in my opinion, and let's hope for the best that this virus doesn't evolve to become more pathogenic.
Okay. And then on top of that, this push that we have for vaccination, now that we're going to children, what are your feelings about this new effort to vaccinate down to 6 months old?
I think you already know the answer.
I wouldn't have asked the question if I did.
The organization that I represent has already put out a position and a press conference filmed here in Austin, by the way, that in our opinion, there is no rationale for vaccinating these young children. They do not get severe disease. And furthermore, about 75% of them, based on serology, have already been infected. The very young child that they're talking about is the period of time when their thymus is developing most rapidly and is differentiating self and non-self. And it may well be with these policies that we create something even worse than the original antigenic sin problem we're seeing in adults. Because children are at a period, these young children are at a period in which their thymus is actively learning what is self and what is not self. It's in a super responsive state, which is why your children shrug this off. They actually have better immune systems than we do. And in my opinion, we're going to look back at what just happened at the FDA and the CDC. It's going to be historic. In terms of bad judgment, that's my professional opinion as a vaccinologist and an immunologist. I think that there's no reason. They're not at risk for the disease. They're not major contributors to overall spread. And deployment of vaccines into that population with these characteristics is particularly high risk outside of the myocarditis. As another paper just came out, incidence of myocarditis in young boys, 1 in 1,700. Yet another one that confirms the Singapore study. This is not trivial, and this is clinical myocarditis. I cannot believe what just happened. A lot of us are gobsmacked. So that's our opinion, is not just me, that there is no rationale for vaccinating your child right now.
And on top of those reports, I just got another one on military, the problem we're having now of losing military pilots. It's not being reported. I believe there have been some whistleblowers that brought out some of the data, but that is continuing, and we are liable to find ourselves not having sufficient military pilots.
I am embraced by pilots every time I travel now. They seek me out. They know what's going on. I've given sworn testimony in Honolulu to a captain level JAG about this. I've had personal conversations with Teresa Long, and understand in detail what the course of the events were with DMED. There's a lot more depth in terms of what's happened with the Department of Defense that I could go into, but I don't think this is the forum because it's not about the state of Texas. But what's going on is absolutely not okay, in my opinion.
Last question is that make sure I heard you, because it's a question I'd ask of our folks just before that about blindly following CDC and FDA, and I think what I heard you say is that their credibility has reached the point that Texas, in order to serve the people of Texas, needs to look at figuring out how to handle these problems themselves and not just continue to blindly accept anything the federal government sends down for us to do.
Shockingly, according to the New York Times, the CDC has been withholding data all the way through the outbreak in the justification that if they had not withheld data, it would have increased vaccine hesitancy, which is another way of saying if we told you what's really going on, you wouldn't take the jab, to speak plainly. And they have, according to the New York Times, become a politicized branch of the government, which is absolutely not consistent with their federal remit as the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. They are explicitly supposed to be apolitical, with the exception of the appointed director who reports to the executive, but that is not what's happening anymore. And I do believe that the state of Texas has an obligation to the citizens of Texas to step up and take action. And I also believe, paradoxically, that it'll be in your business interest, too.
Thanks, Dr. Malone.
A quick follow-up, Dr. Malone, about therapeutics. I've spoken to Tamiflu, that's the brand name, I believe, and its effectiveness on helping shorten the long-term effects of influenza. Why are we not focusing more on therapeutics? Where is that?
Part of my history in this that I don't talk about very much is that since that phone call, I was leading a mid-sized, very high-tech, cutting-edge Defense Threat Reduction Agency team looking at repurposing drugs and developing new drugs. That evolved into a multi-million-dollar contract that was largely managed by the Lincoln Lab at MIT, with me as one of the primary consultants focused on drug repurposing. That led to another very large contract with SAIC. Leidos is now what it's called, to try to move forward a drug combination of celecoxib and famotidine. We encountered resistance from the FDA. This is the DOD. Encountered resistance from the FDA in moving that trial forward like none of us have ever seen in our lives, and we were all seasoned, battle-hardened, professional clinical researchers. Something is rotten in Denmark, and there's, you know, the kindest explanation is that if there are alternative medicines available that would prevent the disease, then the rationale for emergency use authorization by statute will have to be halted. That is the kindest explanation I can come up with.
Say that one more time so I understand that. If what will be halted?
Under the statute for emergency use authorization, federal statute, it requires that there be no effective alternative treatments in order to authorize or maintain an emergency use authorized agent. In other words, everybody keeps talking the talk that these are licensed vaccines and FDA approved. They are absolutely not. Remdesivir is recently, most of these agents are being allowed by the FDA under a special clause called emergency use authorization, and if the medical emergency declared by the executive branch is terminated, or there is, or had been, an effective alternative to these experimental products, then it would, by statute, these experimental products could not have been emergency use authorized.
So staying along the mRNA, there are two vaccines that are mRNA. We know Moderna and Pfizer. Very little talk about J&J or the Janssen, which is more of a traditional vaccine.
It's a recombinant adenovirus vector. It's also a gene therapy applied to vaccination. The closest thing that we have to a traditional vaccine for this coronavirus, and remember, all prior efforts to develop a corona vaccine have failed. The closest we have is the Novavax product.
Novavax.
And that's not really even traditional in that it is manufactured in caterpillar cells with a novel adjuvant derived from the bark of a tree.
I've talked about Novavax for a long time. Why has it not received emergency?
Oh boy, we're down in the weeds. Yes, I know about this. I used to consult for them for their in their prior company, the leadership of Novavax. They ran into two problems. They're essentially supply chain problems as well as safety problems. They did not lock down sufficient supply chain for the adjuvant that they were using, which is also used in other vaccines, and much of which comes from China, as I understand it. So they had a supply chain problem, and they also had a safety and a lot consistency manufacturability problem. Now, a cynic might say that there is been a bias towards advancing the mRNA vaccines as opposed to any other alternatives. And in fact, Tony Fauci is on record as saying, we don't need any other vaccines, we have the best. That being the mRNA vaccines, which NIAID is deriving revenue in patents. I mean, this is just the truth. Okay? So there's no question that Tony had a bias. And if you want to get inside baseball with DC politics, Rick Bright may, one of the reasons why he may have been terminated from his position at Asper is because he didn't get Tony Fauci's permission to put the hundreds of millions of dollars into the J&J product, which Tony didn't really want to advance. That's the buzz. But there's a lot of dynamics here that have to do with conflicts of interest. And you would hope that this would all be open and transparent and we would just be doing the best for the people. But it's D.C.
Lastly, there are some people who have never contracted. Who are those people?
There's a fascinating study, I think it's out of Sweden, that looked at healthcare workers early on that were continually chronically exposed, and they developed an IG, predominantly IgA response. This is a mucosal antibody that's produced when you experience the antigen in your nasopharynx. Oh, if I can circle back a key point, one of the key reasons why masks don't work is because there's three routes of infection: your eyes, your nose, and your mouth. And the masks don't cover your eyes. So there's that. But getting back, the issue here is that these products have,
people that
in the case of these healthcare workers, they were chronically exposed apparently to low level of virus through their nasopharynx and their eyes. They appear to have developed a subset, a mucosal immune response, without ever becoming clinically diseased. So they had low level exposure, they developed a mucosal IgA response, and they seem to have been almost completely protected and are able to continue in their healthcare work without the need for a vaccine. That's the best data that I know of that can address your question.
Excellent. Thank you. Members, any other questions? Thank you for being here, Dr. Malone. We appreciate your candidness and your past research and your opinions today as well.
Thank you, ma'am. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you so much. The chair calls Dr. Eric.
Of censorship and everyone who dares challenge the narrative being labeled someone spreading misinformation. I'm all too familiar with that. Someone I didn't expect to see on that list was Dr. Peter McCullough, who's recently come under fire by the American Board of Internal Medicine. for spreading misinformation. You've got to be kidding me. This is the most published doctor on the earth, someone who's saved millions of lives through his protocol and his efforts. Thankfully, Senator Ron Johnson came in to support him, and there was recently a Senate Committee on Health and Human Services held. And Dr. McCullough joins us to discuss that today. We're joined today by Dr. Peter McCullough, the most published doctor in the world, an expert in his field, and can I just say, an absolute hero who has saved so many lives throughout this pandemic. He has led the way for doctors across the globe to speak up, to have courage to face medical boards, to have courage to face big pharma, to have courage to offer a different alternative, I don't know, early treatment that is saving lives, for example. I've seen him on multiple conferences here with Australian doctors, with doctors all across the world. This is a doctor that actually cares about humanity. And he's joining us here today because the American Board of Internal Medicine has sent him a letter that I'd like to discuss. He's under fire now for saving lives. Dr. McCullough, thank you so much for joining us today.
Maria, it's great to be back on your show. I do have to compliment you. So many women in America look up to you as a beacon of freedom across the whole world. And here you are in Australia. You know, if we could come and help you out in any way, we would. We look at Australia as a leading edge of some terrible change that's happening in the world. But as you mentioned, I'm a practicing internist and cardiologist, fully board certified by the American Board of Internal Medicine. We actually have what's called maintenance of certification enrollment. So actually, I chose to every 10 years continue to take very rigorous exams to maintain the certifications there electively. And I've had a perfect track record up until May 26.
So they've, in this letter, there's language around having made numerous dangerous claims about the dangers or lack of justification for COVID-19 vaccines. Forgive me if I'm misquoting this letter that's been sent to you, and that you've been providing false or inaccurate info. Before we get into the discussion around this claim about false or inaccurate information, I want to ask you a question, Dr. McCullough. How many lives have you saved?
You know, the McCullough protocol that's known across the world, which is called sequence multi-drug therapy for COVID-19, it's just the concepts of putting drugs together in combination to treat patients who are very high risk, we know from risk stratification or presenting with severe symptoms. The estimate is that it has spared tens of millions of hospitalizations and saved millions of lives. Some have attributed that to these concepts, and it's not just me, but I would give great credit to Dr. Didier Rialt in France, to Vladimir Zelenko in Monroe, New York, Dr. Corey and Dr. Merrick of the Frontline Critical Care Network, the frontline doctors. In aggregate, our efforts have undoubtedly saved millions of lives, and it is shocking that the doctors, and by the way, I wasn't the only other doctor to get one of these letters. It's the other hero doctors that Australians and Americans know. We got these letters, which represent a clear attack on our professional status.
It is a clear attack on your professional status. I have your book, The Courage to Face COVID-19. And I just want to read for the audience something out of the beginning where John Leake's writing. And he says, shortly after Halloween, someone sent me a YouTube video of Dr. Peter McCullough standing in a park wearing a jogging outfit. In the video, he was talking about the early treatment of COVID-19 in order to prevent hospitalization and death. This struck me as both marvelous and odd. For months, our public health officials had told us there was no treatment. There is no treatment for COVID-19. And yet, he was the vice chief of internal medicine at Bayer University Medical Center telling us that the disease is treatable. His message gave me hope, the first time I'd felt it since March. I gave a message recently at the conference that was held in Bath by the World Council for Health. Quick message. And I made the statement that the doctors that were in that room were household names because of the fact that they were heroes, because of the fact that the whole world was looking to them for hope, Dr. McCullough, when everything that was given to the public was fear and manipulation and coercion tactics. What John Leake has written here is what I think millions of people around the globe felt and continue to feel when they hear people like you and the others that you mentioned speaking out, because you're offering an alternative. You're offering something that's safe, that's not harmful, and is saving lives. So why the censorship? Why the attack on the careers of those who are actually helping humanity?
Those who are attacking doctors who are treating COVID-19 early, reducing hospitalizations and deaths, trying to save patients, fulfilling their Hippocratic Oath, those attacking us are the same ones who are promoting mass vaccination with no evaluation on safety and efficacy. And you know, this claim of information or misinformation, nobody has a license for this. The American Board of Internal Medicine has no more authority with respect to interpretation of scientific data than I do. In fact, no one on that letterhead is considered a person of medical authority. I am. I have one of the greatest bases of publication and scientific data anybody right now on the planet. I'm the most published person in the interface between heart and kidney disease in the world in history. And I'm one of the most cited and seasoned evaluators of data that's published on COVID-19. And I've published as strongly as I can in this area. I was a regular contributor in The Hill, a Washington Insider journal by invitation in the first year of the pandemic, second year of the pandemic, a regular contributor on America Out Loud Talk Radio, the McCullough Report. People know me because I'm a frequent news commentator on ABC, Fox News, Newsmax, OAN. I've been on Australian TV multiple times, European TV. I've been on TV in India. And, you know, so why are people asking for my opinion? They're asking for my opinion because I evaluate the data, and what I say is cited, it's tractable, and it's backed up, every word of it. And I can tell you the American board is going nowhere with this attack because my response letter is pinpoint, every statement supported by the scientific evidence.
And I'm a little bit angry, Dr. McCullough. I'm a little bit angry, I'll be honest with you. Because I feel as though if more doctors had courage to speak out sooner across the globe, we may not be in this situation now. I mean, there are still not enough doctors speaking out. The reason that censorship has been so successful is because it's still a minority that are speaking out against the mainstream narrative.
It's so true. You know, you're right. Doctors were key in advancing this vaccine narrative and this agenda of worldwide mass vaccination. And doctors were co-opted into it, partly by corruption of the medical literature, of which now all we see is many fraudulent papers, biased papers, extolling the virtues of the vaccines without really any scientific support. The vaccine program in the United States actually went to the hospitals first and started vaccinating the young doctors. They did that before they even got to the nursing homes or the elderly. So from the very beginning, they basically captured these doctors with injections of genetic material coding for the Wuhan spike protein. So once we started to learn about all the safety concerns, most of these doctors figured, oh my gosh, I took a risk. You know, other people better take it too. So doctors were basically entrained in what's called mass formation through the vaccination program.
And some of the statements that that have been brought to your attention that you've made, it says, for example, I'm talking about this letter that's been sent to you, for example, in March 10th, 2021 testimony before the Texas Senate Committee on Health and Human Services, you stated, among other things, that people who have had COVID have complete and durable immunity. There is no scientific, clinical, or safety rationale for ever vaccinating a COVID-recovered patient. I think that that's still the case, or at least not with the current vaccines because they're not effective. The population had already achieved 80% herd immunity. That could have been the case at the time. There's no scientific rationale for healthy people under 50 to receive a COVID vaccine. Well, you can see that the most vaccinated countries right now, or the places with the highest vaccine rates, have the most people in hospital. Can you talk to us about that? Why are all these injected people in hospital?
Well, let's unpack that a little bit. Remember that the scientific information changed as the virus mutated. So wild type through Delta one didn't get a second infection. And I quote the papers by Mirchu and colleagues, which showed that the chances of a clinical reinfection were negligible. As a matter of fact, I'm not sure any of them were substantiated. But Omicron broke through natural immunity. And as soon as that happened, I was on national TV telling Americans that, in fact, watch out, Omicron can actually reinfect somebody who previously had the illness. We had papers from Raw, Kramer, and Mathudius showing if you already had COVID, you took a vaccine, there were higher rates of safety events, including ones that landed people in the hospital. So we knew that one was secure. Now, I had used the CDC equation to calculate herd immunity. And so when I declared herd immunity at 80% for Texas, that doesn't mean that COVID is over with. There was still 20% of the state is still a large fraction. But in fact, what that meant is it wasn't going to spread so readily. And indeed, that was true. They relied on that to open up Texas Stadium and a variety of big public venues. We never had any lockdowns after that fact. And then when Omicron broke through natural immunity, herd immunity as a concept became a moot point. So I have all these answered. But here's what I want the listeners to understand. That was sworn testimony under oath, just as I done yesterday. That means I am swearing the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth, to the best of my ability. I am trying to represent the truth to the best of my ability. And that's the only thing I need to do when I testify under oath. Can you imagine an engineer, a nurse, an accountant, another professional, that what they say under oath as to the best of their ability actually puts themselves in professional jeopardy? If we can't have any protection for state and federal witnesses to give testimony, boy, are we in trouble.
Well, hang on a minute. Fauci said that the vaccines are, what, 95% effective? Is anyone pulling him over the coals for that? Pfizer said that their vaccine is 90-something percent effective. I don't even know. It's changed so many times. Is anyone pulling them over the coals for that? I mean, the double standard here is unbelievable. We give allowance to these people for the fact that the science changes or the science evolves. But when it comes to someone who's actually been helping people, there's no allowance there. And the difference between this conversation, Dr. McCullough, and the one where, we only have pharma-funded mainstream media having conversations with Fauci is I'm actually able to ask you these questions and you're able to answer them honestly. Whereas
it's true
there's no accountability on the other end. Sorry, go on.
Right. There's no accountability, let's say, for the vaccine manufacturer CEOs when they go on TV. They're not asked anything about deaths that have happened with the vaccine. It's true that the government agency officials are not asked regarding safety of the vaccine or asked to explain anything. It's almost as if the media is in complicit lockstep with the federal objective for mass vaccination within every country in the world. You know, the most objectionable statement you could say in that report, and it's obvious that they must have assigned somebody to me and looked through my public statements. You know, some of the other doctors that were in this roundup by the American Board of Internal Medicine, they went back to 2020. They went 2 years ago to try to hit doctors on statements. They may have been on TV and they made a statement. And you know, when you're on TV and you're asked a question and it's live, you answer the question to the best of one's ability. And to go back and say, aha, 2 years ago you said this, is an outrage. And again, the board has no monopoly over their understanding of science. There's always two viewpoints. But the most, alarming comment I made, and it was really a derivation. The person interviewing me looked at other things. They put it up on a banner, but he used the word bioweapon, which really implies something of human intent using a biological weapon. And, you know, in my response letter to the American Board, I cited a paper in the journal Military Medicine. First author is Farkas and colleagues, Farkas, and they evaluated SARS-CoV-2, the virus, according to standard military criteria as a bioweapon, and guess what? It qualifies. And their paper, their conclusion is SARS-CoV-2 is a bioweapon according to classic military criteria. So every statement that is made is supported. Senator Johnson has gotten involved, as you probably know.
Yes, Yes, so that footage has been uploaded onto my website, zmedia.com, for anyone who hasn't seen it, of that hearing yesterday and your testimony. Well, do we call it a hearing or... Because you've been invited back for a second opinion. Talk to us about that.
Right. So let me just clarify. So the American Bar of Internal Medicine is at the federal or national level. Senator Ron Johnson is a U.S. senator in the overall U.S. Senate. He got involved with the American Bar of Internal Medicine when he realized that, the hero doctors, myself, Pierre Corey, many of the leaders the world knows responding to COVID-19 were hit by the American Board. And Senator Johnson wrote Richard Barron, the CEO of the American Board of Internal Medicine, and said, come out of the shadows and face Dr. McCullough, face his team, and let's have a roundtable open discussion regarding points of concern, vaccine safety, and efficacy. And do you know how Barron responded? He actually threw a tweet on Twitter. He said, we're going to double down and join forces with the American Medical Association and intensify our hunt on the doctors. So what I say to Z Media is game on. Let's bring it on. And if you go on my Twitter feed, when I saw that, I pulled a clip from Matrix 2. That was Neo as he was fighting Mr. Anderson. He kept cloning himself, and it was more and more bad guys going after the good guy in the Matrix. And that's what I felt like. I'm going to be fighting them all off. Now, what happened yesterday was explosive. That was in the Texas Senate. So I had already been nailed professionally for statements under oath March 10th of 2021. Now I'm invited back for round two, June 27th, 2022. And so here we go. There was 8 hours of testimony by bureaucrats, and now the Health and Human Services Committee, Maria, I was amazed. They had really changed. Every single person from these agencies who gave reports, that the committee said, well, who received early treatment? And how come you don't know the proportions? And who received monoclonal antibodies? And what about these other drugs? They were getting pounded, and not a single bureaucrat knew anything about early treatment.
We've had this discussion before about early treatment, but can we just remind people again that the process is always to try and treat a patient early. We don't let them go to hospital where they're almost dead.
That's so true. We know for every serious infection, let's just take upper respiratory infections and pneumonias, time to first antimicrobial therapy is a quality metric. Pneumococcal pneumonia, atypical pneumonias, mycoplasma, chlamydial pneumonias, they're always treated rapidly. Okay, always, without exception, tuberculosis included. So with this viral infection, of course, time to first treatment really matters. Early treatment matters. And we start actually up in the nose with virucidal washes, dilute hydrogen peroxide or dilute povidone iodine, super effective as a local treatment, can be done up to every 4 hours. We use nutraceuticals and supplements, then we get into antivirals, anti-inflammatories, and severe cases, anticoagulants. It's called the McCullough Protocol. It's been the basis of the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons Home Treatment Guide, Truth for Health Home Guide. Other protocols, very strong, including the FLCC, Frontline Critical Care Network Protocol, that's been spearheaded by Dr. Merrick and Corey, the Rialt and French protocols in Marseille, France. So no one has a claim over this outside the concepts are similar. And we know that early treatment, I've testified under oath in the U.S. Senate January 24th of 2022, that 95% of all hospitalizations and deaths today, with knowing what we know, are completely avoidable.
Those numbers are astronomical. And you're saying that the people that were in attendance, the bureaucrats that were in attendance testifying for 8 hours yesterday, didn't understand early treatment.
They didn't have the data. That was the shocking thing. So when I gave my report, I gave the converse. And the converse is I've reviewed hundreds, if not thousands, of reports of people with COVID-19 who are hospitalized or die. And every single one of them ends up in the hospital or dead because they haven't received early treatment. So hospitalization and death are a product of not receiving pre-hospital treatment. Whether they're vaccinated or not, it's a product of the lack of early treatment. It's not a product of, it's not a result of vaccination. Remember, the vaccine's not treatment. I think everybody understands that. It's actually whether or not someone got early treatment. This is so critical to understand. And the questions were, well, we had so many patients in Texas in the hospital, so many died. The first question, either the chairwoman, who's Senator Quocart, or Senator Bob Hall, who's one of the leads, would ask him is, well, how many people in Texas got early treatment? Can't know. Well, how do you identify early treatment? We don't. And it was just amazing how inept the bureaucrats were. I mean, it was exposing. Now, it was 8 hours of torture. We had doctors waiting in the chambers and waiting and waiting and waiting. So when I came up, I had 2 minutes. It expanded to about 16. And you have all the footage. It is explosive.
It is explosive, absolutely. And what I admire most about it is that even though you're under attack, you've gone in standing your ground, Dr. McCullough, and it's because the truth isn't afraid to be challenged. The truth
is like, yeah, you got it, Maria. The truth is like a lion. Let it out and it'll defend itself. St. Augustine was right. And notice when I testify under oath, I think your readers and listeners can find me all over the internet. I never read. I commit all the citations to memory. I am laser pinpoint with my words, and I let my words sink in.
For anyone who hasn't seen it yet, again, it's linked in the description below, as well as Dr. McCullough's new book, The Courage to Face COVID-19, also linked in the description below. I just want to make that make that comment really quickly before we go on. So what happens now, Dr. McCullough? You've been invited a second time for your opinion. When is that going to be, and what does that look like?
Well, here's the totality. When I had devised early treatment, I was requested by Peter Navarro, who worked in the White House under commercial operations, to help him with expand emergency use of hydroxychloroquine. Then I was invited by Senator Ron Johnson to be the lead witness in the U.S. Senate November 19th of 2020. Then I was invited by Texas Senate Chairwoman Quocart to be a lead witness in the March 10th, 2021 Texas Senate hearings. And subsequently, I co-moderated the second major U.S. Senate session, five-hour session, with Senator Johnson, January 24th of 2022. Now, my second round in the Texas Senate, June 27th, 2022. If you look over, I've testified in multiple state senates as well as houses of legislation. And this is all by invitation. What I want people to know is if I didn't have something important to say, I wouldn't be invited to so many governmental venues to render my opinions under oath.
Absolutely. The reason why you said before you've been on every TV station possible all across the world. And I'm exaggerating here, obviously, but the reason why is because you bring hope. Like I said, like I read from the opening of the book, you bring hope. You bring a solution that is not a one single solution that the public has been offered. Your solution doesn't require that someone loses their job if they don't take it. It's there. It's available. It's going to save a life. There's safety data. There's peer-reviewed studies. And the other alternative is what? Something that we've seen the trial data that's come out that they've known it's going to cause harm, and yet people are going to lose their livelihoods because of this. How likely is it, Dr. McCullough, I want to talk to you about this, because they're saying now in Australia that we may need more boosters for an Omicron-specific variant. They've just told us that here in Australia we can expect 10 million cases in the next few weeks. We're already climbing up. We're already climbing our way up to that because we are a highly injected population. How likely is it that they're going to push more injections for different variants?
I think it's likely, and it's going to be a disaster. In the Texas Senate yesterday, June 27, 2022, Dr. Robert Malone testified by invitation. I mean, that should tell you something. By invitation, he comes to Texas, and he told the committee about a concept called immune imprinting. So what this means is when the first exposure is to the Wuhan spike protein, which is in everybody who takes the vaccine for the first time, or those who had the original Wuhan spike protein, the body's immune system becomes imprinted to respond to that version of the virus. So when they get Omicron, they literally get blown away because the immune system is totally distracted on the wrong version of the virus. And what he's pointing out is this is becoming a disaster. There are emerging data suggesting it's the vaccinated who get the problem over and over again. Those who get it naturally have a robust immune system, and they do remain resilient. They can get a second infection, but it's very modest. Those who've taken the vaccine and more of them are having the more severe outcomes. In every data set that exists now, those in the hospital and dying are mainly the fully vaccinated. This is spelling disaster for people who keep taking these vaccines, especially the genetic vaccines, Pfizer and Moderna.
We've been told that we're going to have a manufacturing plant for Moderna here built in Victoria. We've been told that we can expect yearly injections, yearly boosters from Albert Bourla, from Pfizer. Are these people ever going to stop?
I don't know how the human body can keep taking the foreign genetic code devised in the biosecurity lab in Wuhan, China. We know that in a paper by Rokin and colleagues, it doesn't get out of the body. It's been found in lymph nodes 2 months later, and that's when they stopped looking. It may still be there. The synthetic analog caps on the messenger RNA do not break down by RNA ACEs. We know in a paper by lead investigator, Dr. Yang D. Marinus from Malmo, Sweden, that Pfizer reverse transcribes through an endogenous reverse transcriptase called line 1. That means that Pfizer actually gets installed into the human DNA. This is an awful discovery. We're waiting for labs to replicate it, but that's going to happen shortly, I anticipate. We're in trouble. People who keep taking more and more of this, they're converting their cells to permanently carrying the genetic code for the Wuhan spike protein. We know this spike protein damages cells, creates disease. Our FDA tells us it causes heart damage, causes blood clotting and brain damage. The peer-reviewed published literature clearly shows it causes immune system and hematologic disease. You do not want to carry the genetic code for a protein that was devised in a lab in Wuhan, China. It just, the human Australian bodies and American bodies should not be carrying code for a Chinese a spike protein. This is a diabolical thought.
And this discovery about the human DNA changes, is it possible that this is an accident?
Yeah, I've looked over it fairly carefully and had serious conversations with experts. We know that the code for the spike protein is about 444 base pairs, 4,000, I'm sorry, and 4,200, 4,400 base pairs. What transcribed was something they were sure could be identified as a signal, was called the amplicon, but they picked 444 base pairs in the middle. So the question is, if the middle part of the code transcribes and gets into human chromatin, and it did in this paper within 6 hours, I mean, this is fast. I mean, this stuff gets permanently installed within about 6 hours, that if the center part of the code installs, would the whole thing encode? And most experts think the answer is yes. Now, the next steps are to see, indeed, what does it do once it installs into the human genome? Does it produce spike protein? Is it repressed? Is it only under certain stress conditions will the spike protein be produced? How does the body respond to that? You know, I had a doctor on the McCullough Report, a Greek scientist from Italy, I believe Dr. Polycretis is his name. He thinks every cell that expresses spike protein is killed instantaneously. So that's a different viewpoint. That viewpoint would suggest it never would do an install because the bottom line is the human body is killing cells that are expressing it. So when you take a vaccine, the body becomes at war with itself, basically. And so we really don't know what's happening. There's so much conjecture that, you know, the safest approach is simply not to take these and never have all these concerns start to occur in your body.
In the next segment, we discuss the DNA damage that has happened to human beings and a controversial new treatment that could be a potential solution, but it's one that I've been warning against. However, I certainly will never censor a health professional from giving their opinion. And we also discuss sudden adult death syndrome and what we can expect to see, particularly alarmingly in children. As well as this, we also discuss how to support Dr. McCullough. He's got letters uploaded on his link tree. That is linked in the description below, so please do have a look at that. Subscribe to Red Voice Media Premium right now. $1 premium trials. Support this platform. It is a beacon of light, a beacon of truth for the whole world. I think I heard Dr. Jane Ruby say recently 10 million viewers across the world. That is astronomical numbers, and we want to keep that going. As well, we all know that difficult times are coming ahead. So prepare with Heaven's Harvest today, the sponsor of this show, that offer emergency survival foods such as protein survival buckets, entree survival buckets, breakfast survival buckets, and heirloom seeds where you can actually grow your own food to make sure that you're protected from big ag, water filtration and storage, and gardening survival resources. As well as this, Dr. Zelenko has saved thousands of lives through his protocol. And he has Z-Detox, Z-Stack, and also vitamins for children that will help support your immune system, and he says may reverse the harmful effects of these injections if you or your family have had them. The link for all of that is in the description below. I will see you in the next segment.
And when we think about those voices that have made this difference, that have really brought truth to the science, brought truth to the medicine, I can't think of a greater voice than Dr. Peter McCullough. And I have breaking news right now. He sent over a letter that he just received from the American Board of Internal Medicine. And it reads as follows. Dear Dr. McCullough, diplomats of the American Board of Internal Medicine are a community of physicians who commit to be guided by evidence-based medicine. ABIM grants certification based on the judgment of expert peers who are familiar with the literature and medical practice. Our community holds us accountable for ensuring our standards are met. You are currently certified by ABIM. ABIM has learned that you have made numerous widely reported and disseminated public statements about the purported dangers of or lack of justification for COVID vaccines. And let me just jump to the point of this letter. While ABIM recognizes the importance of legitimate scientific debate, physicians have an ethical and professional responsibility to provide information that is factual, scientifically grounded, and consensus-driven. Providing false or inaccurate information to patients or the public is unprofessional and unethical and violates the trust that the profession of medicine and the public have in ABIM board certification. Therefore, such conduct constitutes grounds for disciplinary sanctions. Obviously, this is a letter warning Dr. Peter McCullough that he is now under some sort of investigation. I'm joined right now by Dr. McCullough. Obviously, these aren't the best of circumstances to be talking to you, but I won't say that I'm surprised. We live in a world of censorship. We've all been censored online, social media platforms, and we have seen other doctors that are being investigated for speaking their truth. And, you know, you've obviously come on the show and brought a lot of truth. So what's going through your mind? Tell me about, you know, what this is about today for you.
No, I'm board certified by the American Board of Internal Medicine continuously since 1991, both as an internist and then later on as a cardiologist. I've poured thousands of dollars into that organization and countless years of my life, as well as endless testing. I have met every standard of that organization to claim board certification by contract. I'm an established expert in my field. I'm the most widely published person on heart-kidney interactions in the world in history, and I've been relied upon by American medicine and medicine worldwide for my scientific inferences. Now, in the last 2 years in COVID-19, I have provided scholarship. I have 56 peer-reviewed publications in the literature in the author block, work with collaborative groups, brought the world early treatment protocols, and I've been a careful analysis physician, a really careful news commentator on vaccine safety and efficacy. I was shocked to receive this letter. I have responded in a response document that's nearly 24 pages long. Every statement that I've made is carefully cited and sourced with the data, just like you do on the high wire. And now Senator Johnson has put out a public call for an open discussion with the American Board of Internal Medicine.
I've got that letter right here. This is from Senator Johnson's office. This is awesome. Dear Dr. Barron, I'm in receipt of your letter to Dr. Peter McCullough dated May 26, 2022, in which the American Board of Internal Medicine provided notice that the ABIM's Credentials and Certification Committee will hold a meeting to determine whether to recommend any disciplinary sanction against Dr. Peter McCullough. In your letter, you cite a number of evidence-based public opinions Dr. Peter McCullough made regarding COVID-19, natural and herd immunity, asymptomatic spread, and COVID-19 vaccination policy. As you are aware, Dr. McCullough provided testimony before the Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Government Affairs on November 19, 2020, and again on January 24, 2022, during a roundtable event I held in Washington, D.C., titled COVID-19, A Second Opinion. He goes on to talk about how important it is to have a debate, and now he is demanding that a debate happen between you and this board. It is well past time for the public to hear from many sides regarding COVID-19 in a public forum. The purpose of this letter is to invite you, members of your Credentials and Certification Committee, and any other medical expert of your choosing to come to Washington and engage in an open and honest interchange regarding all aspects of COVID-19 without the threat of reprisal by the ABIM or any other organization. First of all, I just want, you know, to have Senator Johnson stepping up like this is so important. Hopefully many more senators will sign on to this demand. It is well past time. I could not agree more. This debate needs to happen. They have gone on. And when I think about this, you know, there are things like, for instance, one of the statements you made that, you know, that natural immunity is long-lasting. We all saw that be affected by Omicron a little bit. I remember even you reached out to Joe Rogan and said through Dr. Malone, please let him know that the science has now shifted on that. We have a new variant. What you were saying was true up until that point, but as all scientists know, the science changes, and you immediately change that perspective. On the other hand, I could point to their statements about the vaccine being 95% effective, how it was going to end this pandemic, none of which ended up being true. We're dropping below 50% efficacy. We're having negative efficacy around the world, all sorts of issues, yet they are not being held accountable. When you think about this double standard, what is it that needs to take place so that we can get back to being honest about how science should be taking place?
Well, Dale, you and I know we have been on the record from the beginning, and none of these members of these various boards and organizations have been publicly on the record regarding the presumption of vaccine safety and efficacy,
right,
and then the science regarding the pandemic. Now's the time to all come out. Let's get around a round table. Let's exchange information without threats, pressure, or threat of reprisal, and let's get the information out to America.
You know, I think what we need to do is because this is happening on the fly, you just reached out to us. I really think we all need to start reaching out to our senators, to our, you know, congressional representatives. I think forward this letter. Say, I support this. I want this debate. This type of witch hunting of good doctors that are simply sharing a different perspective in a world where even the CDC is admitting the science is gray, that it is not some black and white situation. We're trying to find our way through it. We can't have this happening. Everybody, do your part. Reach out. Just say, this letter is, you know, from Senator Johnson. I want you to sign on to it. I want you to agree and demand that this debate take place. I know that you're seeing patients right now, and so you just took this moment. Any last words before you go running off about this situation?
Scientific discourse is critical to medical advancement. This is far more than just my case or other doctors in my circles. This is about the advancement of science. If we do not cut out censorship, if we do not nip this in the bud, Dale, we're in trouble.
I agree. It is really, really scary to think that you can have captured organizations, captured regulatory agencies that are pushing one narrative that seems to benefit, you know, the side of the industry versus, you know, shutting down any commentary from professionals that are siding with citizens and the issues that they're seeing out there. Dr. Peter McCullough, we are going to stand behind you on this. If you need support legally or any other thing from us, the Informed Consent Action Network, which is the nonprofit that makes this show possible, we stand behind you 100%, and we will make sure to get the word out there. And until then, and while all this is going on, our prayers are with you. I want to thank you for taking the time to join us and share this story with us.
Thank you.
All right. Senator Johnson wrote that brilliant letter to support Dr. McCullough, which is so important now that we see and we, and by the way, support the politicians that are supporting our doctors. It is my honor and pleasure to be joined now by Senator Ron Johnson. Senator Johnson, yeah, first of all, I want to thank you for writing a letter for supporting Dr. McCullough the way that you have. But when he reached out to you and you heard about this, what were your first thoughts?
Well, first of all, Dell, it's great to be on your show, and thank you for everything you've been doing in terms of providing the truth to people regarding COVID and the vaccines. I mean, first of all, I was outraged. This little star chamber that the American Board of Internal Medicine is going to conduct against Dr. McCullough is just outrageous. Now, I'm reading the letter providing Dr. McCullough notice of this star chamber, and they're listing all these statements that he's made that are apparently they view as misinformation.
Yeah,
I'm looking. You're going to go up. I think that's the truth. It's interesting. They second page. They let him know that you may make a written submission for the CCC's consideration in connection with this matter, and then they go on to say, please be advised that failure to respond timely to this notice may be considered unprofessional and weighed against you. I mean, this literally is a star chamber, and so.
Yeah.
What I want to do is, in support of Dr. McCullough is write a letter to Dr. Richard Barron, the CEO and the president of this organization, and just let them know that I'm aware of it. The American public is now aware of this proceeding, and that what I've actually done is I've invited Dr. Barron and any people he'd like to bring with him, other medical professionals, to come to Washington, D.C. and engage in a dialogue with people like Dr. McCullough and Dr. Corey and Dr. Merrick and Dr. Cole, and all the people you've had on your show, the people that I've had that's testified before my committee or participate in some of my events. You know, I did an event in November of 2021, again, the COVID-19 second opinion event in January 24th of 2022. I invited all the agency heads or representative from those agencies, the CEOs of the drug companies. They would never show up.
Do they respond at all? Well, I mean, you know, we see you. You're a senator. You have some standing. You're having these hearings. I mean, does Fauci, Francis Collins, like, does anybody respond at all from the other side?
No, they don't even, you know, they don't send regrets or anything. I've written, I think, up to 38 oversight letters to the various health agencies, pretty well laying the groundwork that should I be here for another term. I'd be hopefully chairman of the Permanent Subcommittee Investigation. I'm just laying the groundwork for investigations into all things COVID, all things vaccines, all things in terms of the sabotage of early treatment. But no, I've written 38 oversight letters. I've basically gotten squat. Whether it's the NIH, the CDC, the FDA, now the Departments of Defense on the DMED system. Listen, it's a deep state. The deep state does not give up its secrets very easily. By the way, we're down to, we did request, remember the 4,000 emails from Fauci that were FOIA'd?
Yeah.
We looked at those. We requested 400 of them. We focused on it, 400 unredacted. HHS has allowed us so far to read them in a reading room, 50 pages at a time. We've read 350 pages. We're down to the last 50. They will not give those last 50 pages up to us.
Oh, man.
There must be some pretty explosive information in those last 50 pages.
I can't wait to, I mean, obviously it's so much, it's hard work. We work with Attorney Aaron Seary to FOIA these things. I know that you're acquainted with him also. It's hard to get through to the truth. When they start really pushing back, you know there must be something good there. You know, let me just ask you a question, and you may or may not know the answer to this, but when we look at medical boards like this, right, I mean, on one hand, I find as conservatives, you know, that are out there, we don't want to influence a business and tell them what to do or how to run their business. But when it comes to a medical board, there is some government interaction, right? I mean, because one of my things is, why don't we just start new medical boards? Why don't we just start a new medical board, like, you know, the medical board of real science, or, you know, of the, you know, the medical board of the scientific method. But these medical boards wield a lot of power, and they use a lot of threats, and they are obviously, whether or not they believe what they're saying, they're coerced by a higher power. All the money from pharma that pours into these boards and affects these these universities. You know, is there any space in the political system, in the government, to put pressure? If you had, let's say, a majority of senators that all thought this was the wrong thing to do, is there anything a government can do about a medical board?
I think just ask for transparency, and that's what I'm doing here.
Yeah.
If they have nothing to hide, don't hide it. Right. If you're proud of what you're going to be doing to a wonderful person, Dr. Peter McCullough, who is, let's face it, they're trying to destroy people like Dr. McCullough and Dr.
Yeah.
Corey and the people that have had the courage and compassion first to treat COVID patients and then to speak out, to speak the truth. They're being, the COVID cartel is trying to destroy these individuals. At least they can do it in the light of day. And that's really my attempt here is, listen, if you're going to try and destroy him through the star chamber, through your American Board of Internal Medicine, do it out in the open. Let the public see exactly what you're going to do. You know, listen, both of us, we're accused all the time. They use the pejorative, spreading misinformation, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I always ask, I'm sure you do, well, show me what I'm saying that isn't true.
Right.
Because I don't want to say things that are inaccurate. You know, if I'm wrong, I will correct it immediately, okay? I'll apologize for being wrong. So far, I have never been given any information that I've provided that has been untrue.
Well, because everything we're doing is backed in data. Now, and one of the things I find problematic about this entire misinformation discussion and where it's really wrong, even I get fact-checked by fact-checkers that will say, we found a study that goes against what Dell said. Well, what you found was a study that says something different than the study that I showed. And so there's, you know, differing opinions on the science here, but there's scientific backing, used mostly to my position, but every once in a while to put up a study. But just because you have a study doesn't mean that mine is misinformation if I'm showing science too. Dr. Peter McCullough is going to be able to point to science and evidence that backs up every point he's made. Has there been funded science done by pharma that has set out to have a different conclusion and a different result? Absolutely. But unless there is no existence of science anywhere for something you've said and you're just pulling it out of thin air, this concept of misinformation, we've got to eradicate that from our vernacular because it's being used in a very inappropriate way. And it's getting to be dangerous. I mean, I feel like what we're seeing with Dr. Peter McCullough, as he said, this is dangerous. If we have doctors that are not allowed to actually treat the patient in front of them, are not allowed to use their background of understanding, all of the myriad of patients they've treated, all the different nuances they've experienced that lead them to a different decision on that patient, while a board that is being funded by a pharmaceutical industry trying to sell a singular product is going to override that, is going to mandate that the hospitals all have to do the same thing. This sort of homogenized, pasteurized, you know, medicine will be the death of us. I mean, it is literally going to be the death of us if we all have to take remdesivir, even if it doesn't prove to work for most people, simply because that's the, you know, the appropriate science, and anything against it is misinformation. When you got involved in politics, did you ever imagine, I mean, I imagine you got involved because you knew there were problems in the world, but I mean, it just went on steroids the minute, you know, you sort of stepped inside the Capitol there. I mean, just lastly, what's it like to be, you know, in some ways a lone voice in this incredible, insane time?
Well, first of all, the pandemic has exposed so many problems in our society, within our medical establishment. There is no perfect medical information. Every human being is different. Everybody reacts differently to different drugs. What drives me nuts is when I'm challenged by medical experts. Okay, yeah, show me the data.
Right.
You know, the one that's driving me nuts right now is this sudden adult death syndrome.
Oh, my God, yeah.
I'm reading articles written about that, and the doctors are baffled. You know, the medical experts are baffled. What could possibly be causing the death of adults just dropping dead? What could it be? And I'm going, isn't it pretty obvious? I mean, you look at the VAERS report, we're up to 28,714 deaths on the VAERS system.
Right.
What did anything change in 2021? Did we do something different in medicine that just might be a possible reason for SADs? But again, the COVID cartel is completely oblivious to it. As I've been saying, they can't afford to be proven wrong. The body count is way too high. They sabotaged early treatment. But Dell, they have the power to make it very difficult to prove them wrong. And that's really the situation we're in. It's why people like Dr. McCullough need to be supported. why I wrote that letter. The public has to be made aware of these things. I think the truth has power, but the truth has to get out there. That's all I'm trying to do. So I'm just trying to convey truth. That's what you're trying to do. That's what Peter McCullough's trying to do. In the end, I got to hope the truth can prevail.
Absolutely. Well, Senator Ron Johnson, as one of the few politicians that's actually working in Washington, D.C., and using taxpayer money appropriately to get something done, I don't want to steal any more of your time. I want to thank you for taking your time to join us today. I want to thank you for being so passionate on this topic and bringing together panels of scientists, what we've only been dreaming about coming together over the last years. I've been involved in trying to get more transparency in the science around medical procedures and products. Your work is outstanding. Your letter, we're going to put it up here, folks. Here's the letter one more time. It will be available to you if you're a member of our newsletter. Get your friends. Just send it to your friends. Say, can you believe this is going on? You know, let's support this. Reach out. Start talking to your elected officials and saying, we can't have these witch hunts. This is insane. This is a highly decorated doctor, one of the most published scientists, doctors in the world, especially on heart issues, and the most published doctor on the COVID pandemic. Senator Ron Johnson, thank you so much, and we'll continue to watch you. And if you need anything from us at any time, please let us know.
Thank you, and stay well. Again, my wish is I just hope these doctors show up. I hope the agency heads, I hope the CEOs of Pfizer and Moderna show up and have a dialogue, have a discussion. If you're so proud of what you've done, get into a dialogue with people like Dr. McCullough and Corey and Merrick.
Agreed. It's time for the debate. It's time. If you have a winning argument, bring it. Otherwise, shut up. All right. Thank you, Senator Ron Johnson. Have a great day. Be blessed. Well, I mean, these are incredible times where it doesn't matter your background. It doesn't matter your success in treating patients. It's as though none of it seems to mean anything. All of the evidence, all the science, Dr. McCullough cites. I mean, you've seen him on our show, the way he can recite so many different studies, and yet, you know, you wonder, does it even matter? I mean, and what is he up against? Just saying he's spreading misinformation, as I said before. How about the fact that you all said this vaccine was 95% effective? You promised us this vaccine was going to end this pandemic and eradicate the disease, and now you're telling us to live with it. You promised us we didn't need masks. Then you promised us we did need masks. Now you're saying maybe we don't need masks. I mean, this is all so crazy. It starts to make you feel like you're crazy.
Good evening and welcome to Tucker Carlson's Night. We're still shocked. Everyone else seems to have moved on to the next thing, but we still can't get over what we saw yesterday when Joe Biden stunned the world and announced during a press conference with no warning at all that he has a potentially fatal disease. I have cancer, Joe Biden said. I got it from living in Delaware. It turns out that Joe Biden's home state is so thoroughly polluted, so supernaturally filthy, that even lepers living in public sewers in Calcutta refuse to go there. It's too unclean. How dirty is Delaware? It is so dirty, Joe Biden said, that when it rains oil. That's why everyone in Delaware gets cancer. They get it from the oil rain. Now Joe Biden has it too. Looking back, voters probably should have known a little more about Joe Biden's Delaware-related risk factors before he became president. It's too late now, and it just got worse. Not only is Biden sick from Delaware's oil rain, now he's got COVID. The White House announced it today. So it's been a tough week overall. Wednesday it was cancer. Thursday it was the coronavirus. Tomorrow you've got to think it's going to be monkeypox. If you or someone you know has recently had unsafe sex with Joe Biden, please seek precautionary medical attention. God knows what you might have picked up. At the White House, they are genuinely upset by today's news, not because they're worried about Joe Biden's health. Everybody who works at the White House already knows he's so thoroughly unwell he can barely speak. These are the people who run his teleprompter. They're the ones who put the little pieces of tape on the floor so he knows where the door is. These are not people who have any illusions at all about Joe Biden's condition. What they're upset about is the fact that Joe Biden just stepped on their message. And from day one, that message has been consistent and unrelenting. Get the vax or else. Get the vax, you can't have a job or an organ transplant or Thanksgiving with your kids. Get the vax, you can't visit your mom as she dies in the hospital. Get the vax, Prol. It's the most important thing that you can do, and you're a monster if you don't. So people obeyed. They did it. Okay, they said, we'll take the vax. Doesn't look like we have a choice. But are you sure it works? It's pretty hard to make a successful vaccine against a coronavirus. In fact, nobody's ever done it. We tried with SARS almost 20 years ago, and that failed completely. So are you absolutely positive this stuff works? Are you sure it's safe and effective? Of course we're positive, screamed the mannequin. We're the U.S. government. We know these things. We don't make mistakes. Stop asking questions. Questions have no place in science. Just take this shot and you will not get COVID. That's guaranteed. Joe Biden said that. He didn't just say it once. He said it many, many, many times.
The fact is, this has been a pandemic of the unvaccinated.
The Delta virus, which is much more transmissible and more deadly in terms of non-unvaccinated people, the various shots that people are getting now cover that. You're okay. You're not going to get COVID if you have these vaccinations.
If you're unvaccinated, you have some reason to be alarmed. Many of you will, you'll experience severe illness in many cases if you get COVID-19, if you're not vaccinated. Some will die. We have in hand all the vaccines we need to get every American fully vaccinated, including the booster shot. So there's no excuse for anyone being unvaccinated. This continues to be a pandemic of the unvaccinated.
Yeah, there's no excuse. And if you don't get the vax, you're going to die from COVID. You're going to get COVID if you don't get the vax. Now, if he said that once or maybe like 11 times, you could say he's got dementia, whatever. He said it pretty much every day. And he's not the only one. They all did, beginning with Lord Fauci.
Need for yet again another boost, in this case, a fourth dose boost for an individual receiving the mRNA.
And then the issue of vaccines, actually, at least with regard to SARS-CoV-2, can do better than nature.
When people are vaccinated, they can feel safe that they are not going to get infected.
So it turns out once you get vaccinated, you can feel safe. You're not going to get infected. You're not like the dirty people who didn't get the vax, the anti-science people who are all going to die. And when they do, we're going to laugh at them because they deserve it. And by the way, it wasn't just Biden who's just reading the script. It wasn't just Fauci, who will say whatever it takes and is, of course, covering up his own role in creating the virus in the first place. Even actual doctors, even the head of the CDC, even Rochelle Walensky herself said the same thing.
Our data from the CDC today suggests, that vaccinated people do not carry the virus, don't get sick, and that it's not just in the clinical trials, but it's also in real-world data.
Yeah, it's not just in the clinical trials. It's in real-world data. Just look around. Observed reality. You don't know anyone who's gotten the vax and then got everybody who got the vax got COVID. How does that work? Well, they never explained. They stopped telling you it was a pandemic of the unvaccinated because that was so obviously untrue. You got the vax and you still got COVID. So they stopped saying anything at all, and they hoped you would forget about what they said for a full year and all the thousands of people whose lives they destroyed on the basis of that lie. But what they didn't do ever was apologize for it. They hoped they wouldn't have to. But then last Friday, Joe Biden, again, the president of the United States, became visibly symptomatic with something during a speech in Jerusalem. Watch.
I was making a speech and I had a terrible headache. Excuse me, a terrible headache. And I had a terrible headache. This is years ago, and I did a very stupid thing.
Remember when you were a kid, all the public health authorities were trying to stamp out cigarette smoking, and they printed these huge posters of a wino dying of cirrhosis, tugging on a pell-mell. They said smoking is very glamorous. In other words, don't be this guy. Well, if we ever have another pandemic, let's hope we don't, but if we ever do, play that tape. That's what you don't do. Remember the CDC and its guidance? When you develop symptoms, you isolate immediately. You don't cough on people at press conferences. Those are the rules that your kids lived by at school. That's why they wore the little masks. They couldn't breathe. Your children were also told to scan QR codes for contact tracing purposes if they ever developed COVID, a dry cough. But today, Joe Biden gets COVID, and when reporters asked how he got it and why he didn't isolate after getting symptoms, the response from the White House press secretary was, and we're quoting here, I don't think that matters. It just doesn't matter. Turns out it doesn't matter. Go ahead and super spread if you want to. So if you're on Air Force One yesterday, or you went to the big press conference in Massachusetts, or if you were the recipient of a fist bump in Saudi Arabia, you may have the Rona. But nobody cares. I don't think that matters, says Karine Jean-Pierre, the president's glass ceiling shattering publicist. So obviously they're hypocrites. Did you know that? Had you heard that before? Well, now you can mark that down as confirmed. That's only part of the story. And we don't want to ignore the fact that the real story is the President of the United States is 79 years old and has a, how to put it, complicated medical history, and now he's got COVID. So what does that mean? Well, sincerely, we hope he's going to be okay. We do know he's going to lose his sense of smell, maybe forever. What does that mean? No more sniffing little girls. If you're Joe Biden and your main source of pleasure at this late stage in your life is sniffing the hair of unsuspecting, defenseless little girls, and then you can't even smell it? Imagine that. Let's say you're riding your bike and you see a little girl and you think, oh, I'd love to sniff her hair. Oh, man, no sense of smell. So actually, the costs of COVID are a little more profound than sometimes we understand. What's kind of weird from a political perspective is that Biden got infected with COVID at exactly the moment his approval rating has reached its lowest ebb, not just with normal people, but with Democrats. He's 19% among Hispanic voters. Red alert, anyone? And this also comes at exactly the same moment that his son faces possible felony charges. Huh. And also, needless to say, at the moment that his dementia has become so obvious that no one can possibly deny it. I'm in Israel to honor the Holocaust, he just said. Oh, it's so awful. So what does this mean? Well, this incites the blood instincts of others in his party. Gretchen Whitmer, probably sitting in her rec room right now polishing a resume. I could replace him. But the real story here is the medical story. Joe Biden and a whole lot of other people have gotten pretty sick with COVID after getting multiple shots. What is that about exactly? How did that happen? It's easy to just mock that this is a pandemic of the unvaccinated. That's clearly untrue. But is there a connection between getting multiple COVID vac shots and getting sicker? Is it possible that the vaccine actually can hurt you, especially if you keep getting boosted? Can it weaken your immune system? Well, that looks possible. Multiple studies have looked into this. Just last month, the Journal of Food and Chemical Toxicology published the findings of several mRNA researchers, and we're quoting, "In this paper, we present evidence that vaccination induces a profound impairment in type 1 interferon signaling, which has diverse adverse consequences to human health." Well, that seems like a headline. Did you read that in the New York Times? No, you probably didn't. Kind of weird, since hundreds of millions of people got the shot. The researchers continued that in their studies of the COVID vaccine, quote, "we identified potential profound disturbances in regulatory control of protein synthesis and cancer surveillance. These disturbances potentially have a causal link to neurodegenerative disease, myocarditis, Bell's palsy, liver disease, impaired adaptive immunity, impaired DNA damage response, etc." So it's possible, in fact, it's looking likely, that the vaccine might suppress the immune system. This fact, the authors concluded, will, quote, "have a wide range of consequences, not the least of which include the reactivation of latent viral infections and the reduced ability to effectively combat future infections," end quote. Now, again, we sincerely hope that's not true. But it's not just the conclusion of one scientific journal. The Lancet, maybe the most famous scientific journal in the world, released similar findings in February. The Lancet's piece was entitled, quote, "Risk of infection, hospitalization, and death up to 9 months after a second dose of COVID-19 vaccine." A physician called Kenji Yamamoto made this observation about the data from The Lancet. He wrote this in a letter to the Journal of Virology, and we're quoting, "The study showed that immune function among vaccinated individuals 8 months after the administration of two doses of COVID-19 vaccine was lower than that among the unvaccinated individuals. Ah, now your first response, if you're a humane person, to a line like that has got to be deep sympathy, because people were misled, they were forced. They were forced. Medical ethics thrown out the window. People were forced to take medicine they didn't want, and some of them may have been hurt by it. And you don't have to take this man's word for it. Pull up the Lancet study yourself. You won't find anything of the text of the article saying what Kenji Yamamoto said, which is weird. Why would the Lancet want to hide a major finding like that? We can't say. But if you look at Table 3 in the piece, here's what you'll find buried in the data. Among people around the age of 80 who have been double vaccinated, that would include people like Joe Biden, the per capita rate of medical incidences, including hospitalizations or death, is nearly twice as high as the rate of serious incidents for the unvaccinated. This is 180 days after vaccination. What is that? And why is no one interested? The piece also includes a chart showing negative vaccine efficacy for all ages after 8 months for all participants in the study. So, again, this is sad news for a lot of Americans, but it's also a profound indictment, maybe the greatest indictment in our lifetimes, of our leaders. Their recklessness, their pigheadedness, their dishonesty. Given this, how is the D.C. government, among many others, still requiring school children, public and private school children, to get a COVID vaccine? That's a question that no one asked at today's White House press briefing. How are members of the U.S. military being dismissed without their pensions because they won't take this same vaccine in light of these study results? Is no one paying attention? How is this allowed? But instead, today at the White House briefing, all the questions are about the proof of life video that Joe Biden's office released today. Here it is.
Hey, folks, guess you heard. This morning I tested positive for COVID. But I've been double vaccinated, double boosted. Symptoms are mild, and I really appreciate your inquiry and your concerns. But I'm doing well. I'm getting a lot of work done. I'm going to continue to get it done.
Here's a question. Is there a single public statement Joe Biden has made since Inauguration Day that he did not read off a teleprompter? Is there one? Find it. So the question that came up in today's press briefing was, after seeing that, is who shot that footage? Is that person in danger? Well, once again, the president's glass ceiling shattering publicist, Karine Jean-Pierre, was asked that question. And she said it's totally fine because the video was taken outside. And there's no risk outside that we will arrest you for paddleboarding in California. But then an hour earlier, to make this even messier, because it's inherently messy because it's Biden-related, the White House released this picture. And it shows Joe Biden, brace yourselves, indoors at his desk, no mask. So who shot that picture? Is that person still alive? Does that person have monkeypox? Presumably the White House photographer is vaccinated. That's got to be a requirement working there. But as we just saw, that may make the photographer more vulnerable to infection. And in fact, and we hate to say this, it might mean the photographer is now more likely to face serious health complications. So underlying all of this is a really ominous fact, and that is a lot of people have been hurt by this. You hate to say it. Germany's Ministry of Health found that 1 in 5,000 Germans have suffered, quote, serious side effects after a COVID-19 vaccine. Now, 1 in 5,000 may seem like a lot or a little, but extrapolate forward to the United States, a country with our population. That would mean that in the U.S., if that number holds constant across countries, and why wouldn't it, it would mean more than 100,000 Americans may have been seriously injured by the COVID vaccine. Why does no one talk about them? Why does nobody care? And what happens to them now? If Joe Biden accomplishes a single thing as president, it will be getting more people to ask that question today. And it's a fair question. And to end, science is about questions. Science is questioning. So anyone who tells you you're anti-science for asking a question doesn't understand what science is.